Welcome to Cooking Rice, a series of interviews with people who are as deeply engaged in social transformation as they are in their own personal journeys. Cooking rice is taken from an ancient Asian proverb, well-loved and used by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, to express his commitment and his social vision that inner knowing or wisdom alone is insufficient. Only when joined with transformative engagement with the world does the rice actually get cooked. This is your host, Marty Janowitz. In this episode, I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Lori Mallory, who thought she was headed towards being a dancer, but in her case, the twists and turns led first into meditation, then into medicine, then into geriatrics, and finally, after the death of her father, to become a leading exponent and practitioner of progressive end-of-life care.
Are you one of those people who, when you were a child, you were driven or wanting to become a physician, a doctor, or is this something that came to you along the way in life?
Well, I actually became a doctor by accident. So in all my life as a younger person, I never ever envisioned myself as a physician. More interested in dance, liberal arts, things like that. And it was basically a fluke and just a auspicious coincidence.
Did you just wander into a medical school one day?
Almost like that.
How did that happen?
Well, I was a dancer in New York City and loved to do that. I was with a small professional company there and started having a lot of challenges with dance, physical challenges, knee injuries, and things like that that made it impossible for me to continue. And then I was left with a big void in my life. At that time, I was already practicing Buddhism and just being open to the possibility of what could happen. I started thinking about, well, what would be something that would secure my future, would be interesting, I'd be able to do it and have an interesting job. And I never really formulated what that would be exactly, but I think the teachings gave me the belief in myself that I could do really something that was bigger than what I had ever imagined. So I went back to school, studied science, decided to become a physical therapist because that was somewhat related to dance, and along the way fell in love with science and biology and realized that I could go further with it than physical therapy, although physical therapy is an excellent profession. But I realized that there was more work that I could do beyond that.
No, you haven't mentioned the word health yet.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did your interest in science and biology turn into something focused around health or issues surrounding health?
Well, many people who go into medicine don't really know what they're entering. So I don't know that I really understood I was entering a discipline that involved health. I think I entered that with a fascination of disease and the biological processes and learning and having a career that involved lifelong learning. So those things are what attracted me to the field. And then when you end up in medical school, you find it's somewhat different than you expected.
From what I know about medical school, it's a beyond rigorous experience, you know, very demanding. And at the time, as you said, you were already involved in studying Buddhism. How did those things come together during those quite a few years?
Well, Buddhism, I think, provide a good platform for exertion and to find joy in exertion. So that's one of the things about Buddhism is that it helps you see what your natural skills are. And that's one of my natural skills, discipline. And people think of medicine as a really challenging field, but it's just about discipline. If you're disciplined and you study hard and you pay attention, you'll be a good physician. So it strengthened that ability, and it gave me strength in the solidity of that ability, and I think propelled me forward to succeed in that.
At what point in your studies of medicine did you start to pay attention to your patients?
Well, the patients, you know, are there as a very striking reality, because you know, the patient experience and the stories and your relationship with the patient is completely profound and very sacred. So, you know, you're studying something and you hear about it and then you actually see it in a person, then it becomes a different reality. It's not just, okay, here's how the heart works, here's how it breaks down, but now the heart is breaking down and it actually, you can actually see what that does to a person psychologically, emotionally, and physically. And that's a whole other dimension, which is the beauty of being a physician, that you could actually connect to that human experience. You become really personally involved in everybody's experience of, you know, illness, wellness, suffering, the dying process, and all those things.
Did that surprise you? I mean, it sounds like when you first got into it, you were highly motivated, but it was a little bit of coming from an intellectual place. When you encountered what you just described with patients, was that a shock?
Well, that's life. You know, I think we all experience that every day in our lives, right? We form relationships, we fall in love, we have fights with people. And so this is just continuing that on a, you know, in a different realm and a part of their lives that many people don't know about. And it's just more of the same and maybe a little bit heightened experience of being, having that experience. I mean, interestingly, in medical school they say don't get too attached to the people that you take care of and don't become personally involved, you know, with their health drama, we could call it. And I've always found the opposite, that actually, you know, trying to experience what people are going through, to feel what they're feeling, to take a broader perspective of how their health affects their life and their family and their work, has been really important for me in terms of succeeding as a physician.
There are many different paths through medicine. It's a very broad field, and your path took you, I don't know if initially or ultimately, into working in geriatrics with the elderly, with those closer to death and dying. How did that happen?
That too was an accident, complete accident. So I mean, I went to medical school by accident, just, you know, saying, well, if I could do this, then wouldn't it be good to do the next step? And if I could do that step, well, then I could go to medical school, and it all worked out really well. You know, I mean, when I applied to medical school, it just seemed like a very seamless process. And then I met my husband, Landon Mowry, and he informed me that we were going to move here to Halifax, Nova Scotia.
You were already in medical school?
I had finished medical school and finished my 3-year residency in internal medicine, was ready to practice, and you know, in terms of that message, when we decided to move here, I was not credentialed, so I had to become re-credentialed, and then I had to find a job. And so the process of being credentialed here, you have to take a written exam and an oral exam, and to prepare for your oral exam, you meet with different physicians who watch you and help you practice. And so I met with Roy Fox, who is the head of geriatric medicine. I was already a little demoralized because there was actually no job opportunities in internal medicine. And I had, in Chicago, I'd worked a bit in the emergency department, so I tried to do that here again. It wasn't possible. So, you know, I was studying for this exam. I was at the, you know, very exciting point of a career where you're actually going to start making money and start practicing, and there was no job opportunities. So I met with Roy just as a practice opportunity for this oral examination. And then he gave me feedback afterwards, and he sat me down. And he said, here's my main message. I think you should go into geriatric medicine.
Why?
I to this day, I do not know why he said that. And he said that if I did, he would be able to offer me a training and a job afterwards. So I went home and I cried because that is not at all what I wanted to do, geriatric medicine.
What did you think you wanted to do?
Well, I wanted to do more acute care medicine, internal medicine, you know, take care of people who are younger and have single illnesses, things like that.
As you've gotten into geriatric care, have you discovered those attributes you have, those characteristics you have that Dr. Fox might have intuited?
Well, I'm not sure why he said what he said, but I mean, for me, geriatric medicine has been completely lovely. I mean, it matches what I want to do. It's a field that's exciting. You get to practice high-tech medicine, but you also do it in a different kind of context where you're considering the whole person. So it's been an incredibly satisfying practice, and nothing that, you know, that's sometimes how life goes. You really can't conceptualize where your steps are going to move you. And in my case, you know, when I committed to doing geriatric medicine, I was completely devastated. I felt like I had wrecked my life. I had moved here and compromised what I wanted to do, and yet it turned out really to be the best thing. And that's interesting how life works out like that.
You mentioned that one of the attractions of this field is that it's high-tech medicine. But knowing you and also having recently read the book you wrote about the experience of your father's death period, it seemed that the high-tech part of it was probably one of the most difficult mm-hmm. parts. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, to be a good geriatrician, you have to have a really wide breadth of knowledge. So you have to know everybody's discipline almost as well as they know their own discipline, so that you can understand what kind of treatments are going to be helpful and which are going to be harmful. And so I say high tech, I don't actually mean doing procedures and doing surgeries, things like that. I mean high tech in the sense of knowledge base, that you need a very empowered knowledge base so that you can know what's reversible, what's not reversible, when to intervene and when not to intervene. And so that's been something that I really like about geriatric medicine, is keeping up on my knowledge of internal medicine, so that you could know which drugs work, how they work, how much they cost, whether they're, you know, going to be right for this person, and how much they're going to help and what their adverse effects are. And every single thing about medicine, I try and keep up with that, so that not only can I make the right decisions for the people that I take care of, but also as a way of communicating with the other professionals in health, so that they could understand how to provide a different kind of health care that considers the complexity of illness that people have.
Well, one of the things that I was struck by, Laurie, when I read your book, which, by the way, has the interesting title that we'll get around to, called The Salami Salesman and His Daughter Falafel. But let's hold that thought for a moment. But one of the things I noticed was your description of a lot of the medicine today is focused on a single illness model. One thing wrong with you, fix it. And in line with what you were just saying about a very broad, empowered, multidimensional piece, it sounds like that's not at all the way you conceive of what's going on with the elderly.
Mm-hmm. So the beauty of geriatric medicine is that it looks at each person from a unique vantage point. So if you're 85 years old and you have heart disease and you're healthy, then that's a single illness. And the guidelines and the practices that were developed for younger people actually work quite well for that 85-year-old who's healthy. So it's not really an age thing. What it is when that same 85-year-old now has 4, 5, 6 other problems, some memory problems, trouble functioning in their daily life, maybe some difficulty walking, that same kind of cardiac procedure carries a much bigger risk. And it not only carries a risk of death, which is how, you know, we've really organized our thinking. You know, when we evaluate people for surgery, we say, what is this person's risk of death? But what we're realizing is that those kinds of surgeries carry other risks that are also meaningful to people, like the risk of cognitive decline and functional decline. And so those are the kind of things we want to consider when we're making decisions.
Now, is there any part of what you just said to me that comes to you or became clear to you because you came to it from the perspective of a practitioner of mindfulness, awareness, spirituality, Buddhism, etc.?
Well, I mean, sometimes it's hard to separate those two things. You have your perceptions, your experiences, your translation of them, and then your Buddhist practice, which is underlying all of those things, really. But one of the things that happened to me is that geriatric medicine is very much a restorative-based discipline. So in other words, you know, it started in the United Kingdom, where older people were basically ignored and very poorly taken care of, and they'd get sick, and then all of a sudden their total health would decline because no one was paying attention to how they walked and how they were treated. And so that's where geriatric medicine began. It began from a point of, well, we could do better. We could actually make people healthier by paying attention to the common things that, you know, the threads of how older people decline in their health, which is, you know, decline in mobility, decline in functioning. And so that's the discipline of geriatric medicine. Very exciting. And so where I work at Dalhousie University in Halifax, our division of geriatric medicine is quite good at that restorative part of healthcare in geriatrics. And, you know, we take people who have had hip fractures and can't walk, and we have rehabilitation programs for them, and we don't give up on them, and we make them better, and they go home, and they walk, and they do well, and they live the rest of their lives better than they would have without that restorative kind of treatment. But what I began to notice is that there's a whole group of older people who won't do well no matter what we do. They're just too sick and too frail to really get better. And I began realizing that we don't really have the language or the discipline or the conceptual models of how to take care of people in that condition.
And you've done work on that, and I know you've worked very closely with a colleague here. And I'm interested in how that has evolved and how it's being received by others in the field.
So I think as you come to realize the gaps in healthcare, you know, you look for like-minded people who you could work with. And I think when I had this epiphany, Paige Morehouse, who's the woman that I've worked very closely with to develop a lot of the models that speak to the importance of understanding frailty and how to make healthcare decisions that consider frailty. So she and I started talking, and we were on very much the same page of thinking about these issues. And so together we developed it into a very specific model of care. So we thought about the issues and the challenges and the landscape, and then we thought about, well, how could we do this better? And then we translated that into a model of care that has steps and messages and a way of approaching frailty that actually brings the frailty into focus for not only the healthcare providers, but also the patients and the families themselves, and then to empower each of those groups to make different kinds of decisions.
Are there principles at the core of that that you could translate that are in medicine, but they might also be applicable to other fields that speak to kind of the core basis from which you operate?
The first one, I think, would be honesty. So, I mean, health, the principles of communication, they talk about giving people the autonomy to make their own decisions. But what's missing from that is communication of what's really going on. So families often do not have a good idea of what's happening in terms of the health of their frail older family member. And a lot of the people we deal with have dementia. So again, it's the communication strategy changes because you're not communicating always directly with the patient themselves, but now you're communicating with the patient and their family as a group. So in terms of other disciplines and what that means, if you take an honest approach as your starting point, then often you end up in a different place. And that's our starting point. Well, our starting point is understanding. So we want to understand what we're dealing with, so we do a very comprehensive evaluation of health status, and that includes social health, functional health, traditional medical health, and all those things. Once you have that understanding, then the second step is the communication aspect of it. So you start with sort of a wisdom aspect of knowledge, and then you bring that, what knowledge you've gained, you bring it forward, so that people can understand where they are.
To what extent is listening important? I mean, you're talking about your patients as people, and not just objects of application.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find useful or interesting about that part?
Yeah, I think listening is key to getting the facts. So it's very interesting because typically, we start, many people in terms of their communication model, they start out by asking people, what are your values and what are your goals? And then they listen to that. But what I've realized, and Paige and I have actually incorporated this into our model, is that listening has to start before that. You have to really listen to the patient's and the family's story, and you have to really feel that story and use that story to gain an understanding of what's happening. And that's the first step, is listening to the story of what their health thread has been like. And then in terms of listening, you have to deliver your message so that people can actually listen to what you're saying in terms of giving them information about what their health status is like and what to expect in the future.
Being sick and frail and elderly and heading towards the death experience, I mean, that brings up all kinds of fear. I mean, the one word that pops to mind. Do you have to engage with patients around fear, or is that, I mean, not that I'm any expert on doctors or medicine, but I tend to find less of an emotional experience than I'm feeling as the patient.
Mm-hmm. From what I'm saying.
No, not what you're saying. Just in general, that it's a rare physician that is willing to meet me at the point of how I'm feeling, and I'm wondering if that comes in your work.
The whole process of getting to the point of frailty is a long road. So most people, I mean, some people get frail overnight, if you've had a big stroke, something like that. But for a lot of people, there's been years, a year-long, two-year-long journey. And so the reality of the frailty part of it is actually very, it's very poignant and it's very plausible. So it's different than, if you have a 20-year-old who all of a sudden is sick and maybe dying. You've been through this process for years, and there's more than just fear of death, right? It's fear of loss of independence and fear of loss of cognitive abilities and those kinds of things, and those are already manifesting. And so the conversation, I think, that puts us into an honest conversation where you describe what's happening and why it's happening and what to expect in the future, often that comes as a huge relief to patients and their families, because for the first time someone's actually speaking about things that they're living on a day-to-day basis. And those conversations become a starting point, a new starting point for moving forward.
When you were describing the experience that you and your mom and your sister had working through that last year or two of your father's life, and there was a lot of struggle with the medical system, mm-hmm. on a variety of levels, and then it seemed towards the very, very end, when you finally managed to get your dad out of the hospital into the dying part, when he was at home, and then the hospice people came in. Then it almost seemed like that was like an add-on at the very, very end. And the thought that occurred to me as I was reading that was, and I think you said something about this, that shouldn't have just been the add-on.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that in your practice?
Well, I mean, we start at the very, when we see people who are frail, like my dad was in the last year of life, first of all, we describe each health process, how it's going to progress, and then how to deal with that. And we don't sugarcoat things. So one of the things about taking care of my father, people would say, oh, he's going to get better. Oh, he's going to, he's going to go home and he's going to do well. And it was all about hope, but little honesty about how difficult it was going to be or what the challenges were going to be and how to face those challenges. And so it's those conversations, I think, that are really helpful to people. where you bring forward the issues and, you know, have a balance of hope and fear. And the hope really comes from, you know, the hope that you can actually help your family member through this transition, and that you could actually do it in a way that's very caring and meaningful and spiritual, in the sense that, you know, people are being well cared for and you're contributing to that, and it becomes a meaningful experience.
When I think about this, you know, not old enough yet to be defined in that way, nor in terms of health, but when you get into that, it sounds like kind of grim business. Is there any way in which you've been able to lighten it? Does humor play a role?
Well, it's grim, and it's also, you know, very, I mean, it's, when I think about what my family went through, it's very strengthening. You know, our family was an ordinary family, and my father was the head of our family. You know, very dignified, beautiful, smart person, who always did the right thing. And he helped us all the time. You know, he was, you know, the man of the family. And when he got sick, it was devastating to us. You know, we felt a lot of loss, and that loss was really hard to deal with, you know, in terms of feeling sad and emotional. But it also gave us a new type of strength, you know, that we could meet that with a sense of how to care for him that was very, very loving, and provided him with the best year of life possible, you know, at the end.
This concludes part one of my conversation with Dr. Lori Mallory. Tune in next time for the second part of this conversation. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listening audience. To contribute, go to chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for joining us today.